Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. This is your host, Mo. For those joining us for the first time, welcome. Today, I am so excited. Like, I know I talk to you excited a lot about my guest, but this one, you're just going to understand why. She is a Nigerian social entrepreneur and development expert with a degree in biochemistry. She is the founder and executive director of the Irede Foundation and co-founder of the social group company. She and her team developed a process for providing low-cost prosthetic limbs to child amputees in Nigeria. And they also produced the first ever comic books with superheroes with disabilities in Africa, which they use to educate children in secondary schools while also reducing the societal stigmatization in Nigeria and Africa at large. In the past decade, she has raised millions of dollars and disbursed these funds towards 1,000 prosthetic limbs across 35 states in Nigeria. She has also reached and educated over 15 million people on disability through the annual Out on the Limb advocacy walk, which is held in different locations across the world simultaneously. In partnerships with different partners like Disability Rights Funds, ACT Foundation, UPS Foundation, she and her team are driving the inclusion of children and youth with disabilities in budgeting for education so that children with disabilities can have equal access to quality and inclusive education. She has been featured as a CNN African Voice Changemaker and has won several awards. She is a 2019 Acumen West African Fellow, a member of the Nigerian Network of NGOs, the NNGO, Triple NGO, NNGO, and the International Society for Prosthetics and Orthotics, which is ISPO. She's a certified grief recovery specialist and has authored 3 books. She helps social enterprises and NGOs start, scale, and sustain their enterprises through training, research, and communication. She's also very young, by the way, and she's a mom with kids. So in case she didn't put that one there. So let me just, you know, say with standing ovation and all the flowers that she deserves, you know, giving to her. Please, everyone join us in welcoming Crystal Chigbo to the podcast. Whoa. We're not ready. Anyways, thank you so much. I'm so, so happy to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Mo, for having me. It's such an honor for me.
I know. It's the honor's ours. I've been wanting you for like, I want to say 7 years because Tosin, we're one of the very few guests, first few guests, Tosin Adisa. Shout out to Tosin Adisa of Indwell Studios, by the way. She's our connector. She told me about you and, you know, I think she reached out, but I think it was a very busy time for you. And so the idea was like, you know what, you can always reach out to her later on. And episodes came and went and I was like, you know what, I should bring this lady on the podcast. And everything, you know, worked out and the rest, as I say, is history. So thank you so much. And I know this is going to be one for the books. So I'm so excited to have you as part of our entrepreneurial series. So this is where we've been talking to. So like people that we are inspired by as far as how they run businesses or just their, you know-how skills about how to run businesses. And I think you are just a perfect blend of all of the, you know-hows because you've been doing this for more than a decade. But first, before we jump the gun, let's start from the beginning, right?
Yeah.
What was your foundation like and like how you grew up and just the values that shaped you? And if there were some incidents in your childhood that you can look back to now that you think could have precipitated the current trajectory you're on?
So basically, I come from a family of 10 and I'm the last of 10 children. And growing up, basically, I think my parents kind of instilled in us that it was okay to share whatever it is that you had, no matter how small it was. So we, at the time, we were living in a very small house and we still had people who didn't have homes that lived with us. And we were all able to grow up together and, you know, be fine. So for me, I think that's one big value that my parents instilled, that irrespective of how small whatever it is you have is, you can always share with people. And I think that is what really shaped and formed the person that I became growing up, and just really wanting to help the next person, whether I'm fine or not. I'm thinking of that next person, making sure that that person is fine. Because I think when that person is fine, we will all be fine at the end of the day. Very close knit family, my siblings and I. Like I said, I'm the last of 10 children. I still get airtime from my elder ones. Like I just call them and I'm like, I need you to send me credits, and they will. So we're really closely knit. We come from a religious background, and so we're a family of faith. My dad, when he was alive, was a pastor. And so again, you can really see how these kind of shaped who we became at the end of the day, in terms of, you know, still in the same faith, the Christian faith, where we believe that irrespective, I mean, growing up, my siblings, I had a particular sibling that had a health condition, and you know, it lasted for a long time. She was sick for almost a year. Wow. But we kind of knew that she was going to be fine anyways, that God has her. So again, the tribe of faith, sharing with people and just being good with people, to people, irrespective of what it is that you're going, that is going on with you. And you later understand, because, you know, it's intertwined with my story, with what I currently do today, just knowing that you will be fine and all right.
At the end of the day. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. When you said family of 10, I was thinking, okay, 8 kids and 2 parents, but you said 10 kids.
10.
Like same mom, same dad, but they're twins, triplets, 5 sets of twins.
So I have step siblings.
Okay.
But 5 for my mom and 5 for my stepmom. So.
Okay.
But I'm the 10th of the 10 children.
Wow. This is, I mean, when you talked about your family, and despite having this many of kids and people still joining you and then sharing, and even the little, there's a way you share it and it feels like it goes round, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't have 10 kids, by the way, but there was always so many aunties and uncles coming to stay with us and family members, and you just get used to it. And it's so funny now these days when I cook, not even these days, naturally when I cook, even though I just have a small family, I tend to cook for many people. I don't know how to cook in small scale. So
somehow someone is going to come in.
Exactly. But I live in Oklahoma. Nobody badges in anymore. I miss those days. Yeah. So, and what part of Nigeria are you from?
I am from Lagos State. I'm probably Lagosian. Yes.
Really? I'm from Lagos State. So I'm
from Lagos State.
Yeah, I'm from Ikorodu. Yeah.
I'm from Agbawa Ikosi. So I come from a place just after Ikorodu.
Yeah. Wow. Anyway, so you grew up, and then I can see how just sharing and looking out for the other person has formed, you know, your core values. Now let's talk about your educational pathway. So, what inspired biochemistry? Because what you do right now ain't no bio. I mean, it's bio, but chemistry, maybe there's some chemistry with people, but putting those two together, I mean, it's so far off from what you're currently doing. What influenced that pathway, you know, to biochemistry?
So I don't know about you, Mo, but really, when I was growing up, somehow, at the end of the day, you know, you just do any course that you're given. So that I wanted to be a medical doctor.
Okay.
Again, I wanted to help people. I didn't meet the cutoff mark. And so my brother told me that, don't worry, just take this biochemistry. It's the same thing as medicine. Anything that is just in the medical line is the same thing as medicine. I'm like, no, I want to do medicine. So don't try jump again. Just go ahead and study this biochemistry. In fact, they're like doctors though. They are doctors. That's what my brother told me. And, you know, I never did any research, never did anything. I just believed him for it. I'm like, okay, so this is going to help. And I went ahead, and that's how I studied biochemistry, believing that it's a course that is very close to medicine and surgery. Until I started, and I saw that it was a lot of pathways, and it was way different.
Cycle.
You know, just a path. But you know, I just realized that I actually did follow another path. And, you know, every time I wanted to change, my brother would think, just complete this biochemistry. It's the same thing because you don't know it now. Till I got to year three and I really realized that, you know, there was no point changing the course.
So that's why I should have. Yeah.
It wasn't because I wanted to be a biochemist. Yeah. But I'm grateful I did, because now it's kind of intertwined again with things that I do.
Just
give a perspective when it comes to conversation around the work that I do.
I mean, I think I kind of knew the answer to that question, you know, but I just wanted to give it time. But I just wanted to give you enough time to, like, you know, explain, especially for our non-Nigerian guests. Yeah. I mean, I did JAMB and I didn't make enough scores. And my mom was like, okay, let's just go do a diploma. So they filled out a diploma form. I was able to finally, you know, get into pharmacy. But yes, this happens a lot in our country. The way education is structured, you have to decide what you want to do before you enter university. Here are six students, you know, going like, you know, I haven't decided my major yet. Third year, you haven't decided major.
Third year, you have not decided, no.
As you're actually, the moment you finish college, high school, sorry, you're already deciding your major because Nigerian universities will decide it for you either by fire or by force. Okay, so biochemistry. And what school did you finish from?
University of Lagos!
Look at us, we're just twinning. So Unilag, check, firstborn, check, sorry, lastborn, yeah, I'm firstborn, but we'll take Lagos, check, okay. So, it seems like your siblings formed the first foundation of mentors you had. Were there additional people around you that also, you know, influenced, you know, shaped your journey, especially into social entrepreneurship?
Okay, so I would say that after my siblings, it became someone I met while I was in the university because, he was institutional to my working for Procter & Gamble and then doing what I did. And so when it came to when I was trying to make a decision with respect to leaving my job then and following the path of, social entrepreneurship, he told me that, you know, he saw me along that path. He knew that I was going to do well and kind of encouraged me through the journey. As a matter of fact, I'm still in conversations with him.
Oh,
each
nice.
Time I make a major decision when it comes to work, I would reach out and say, this is what I am thinking of. This is why I'm making this decision. And I would just like to know what you think about it and what your opinion is. So he served almost like a coach for me. I wouldn't say a mentor because what happens is he kind of helps me to answer the questions that I need to answer because he keeps telling me the answers are in the questions. So keep asking those questions till you get to your answer and that will be it. So he's coached me for over 10, 15 years, just really helping me to continue to forge the path. So yes, there's that individual.
I mean, that's thanks for sharing that, by the way. And I love how you emphasize just, how you've been able to keep that relationship going, right? Especially given that you are the one, the way the dynamic is set up is you want to make sure that you're constantly being able to draw from that person's wealth of experience, right? And maybe on your end is intentional that I see this person as somebody that whose, you know, path I could follow or whose wisdom would, you know, guide my life. And that puts you in a place to always ready yourself to constantly receive from that person, right?
Absolutely.
Now, and I love how you just did the distinction between coach and mentoring, because I feel like for a lot of us, it takes a while for you to sink in. As a matter of fact, it took me just starting out in my career in academia to understand that the differences in between a coach and a mentor lies in their approach, the relationship and the goals, right? And if you go and cross your wires and take one, and there's even sponsor, which is like a totally different ball game, right?
Yeah. So,
but I loved how you just emphasized that, okay, this is not just a mentor, this is a coach. And he's been coaching me for the past 10 years and I still reach out to him. Now, my follow-up question to that would be this. Given that we live in a world now, because there was an article I read how men in the workplace are so afraid now of coaching younger women just because of, you know, a lot of issues with Me Too and things are going. And I just think that's a critical, that would be a critical mistake, because I've had great mentors and coaches in my life, and they've not always been women. Especially if you're in a workplace where you have more white men, you know, you can't just always say the people that will coach me or mentor me has people that look like me. And I'm in Oklahoma, so good luck finding another more in Oklahoma, right? But I guess, what are some of the best practices for you as a female being coached by this person who is, you know, different from you in every in sense of that word, especially the gender dynamics? And how do we make sure that women are not in a position where they are preyed upon by men who don't have the best intention, but they want to be coaches? So that's good.
I think the first thing that we did was to define the relationship and say Vic was going to be a coach relationship. Yes. And so that was very clear. So first, it was in the definition of it. So we are friends. And then, you know, we had to migrate to this point where I realized that, okay, this person had so much more to offer me that was from just being friends. So we formalized that process by having that conversation. And as soon as we did, one of the practices that we do is for every conversation, it is documented and the next steps were written, very clearly written down. And, you know, so the next time we're having that conversation or we're having that coach relationship, we would, you know, go back to what it was that we agreed that we were going to do. What have I done with respect to those things and what is going to happen next? We had calendars booked. Yeah. So it wasn't just, you know, off the top of my head, I'll just say, you know what, let me just pick up the phone and call this person. No, one of the key things that we did that's also very distinct is that calendars were blocked. We had calendars pre-blocked and I showed up for my time. If I missed the meeting, so it was recognized as a business meeting, very clearly defined business meeting that needed to happen, and those conversations were had. So it wasn't, I was just passing by.
I just stopped by. Here's the Zoom link. Come and join in the room.
and this was, you know, very clear. And because we put those measures in place, I think one of the key things that he did, was he now really shaped my relationships with other people, because as I journeyed, as I got, you know, to the part of the work that I now do, I started meeting different people, people that I would want to guide me, either mentor, coach, you know, and so I could relate with them in that regard. I made it very, very clear, you know, and had that. One of the things that, you know, almost feels like, especially for a woman, it's not spoken about, right? But subtle is when I went for physical meetings, I was formally dressed. I didn't dress down. And somebody can say, no, I want to be myself. And yes, that was me being myself, because I had to clearly, you know, let you know that it was a business meeting. I remember meeting the owner of Every Woman. So Every Woman is you know, in Nigeria, and she sells outfits for professional women. And one of the conversations she had with me when I was also very young and starting up my career was the importance of how you dressed and being addressed in that same format. So when I was every time I met with my coach going for a meeting, I was formally dressed, like I was ready for that meeting with my notepad and, you know, my pen, always ready to write down. And so because of that, it kind of also set the tone of how the conversation would go. And so did that mean that we did not attend social functions or gatherings together? Yes, we did. And at those ones, you know, following the format and which those things were supposed to be. But I think that, you know, just setting the rules and the guidelines and everything really helped in shaping and allowing myself not to be taken prey of. I would have my agenda ahead of the meeting, what I wanted to discuss. So it wasn't just because it was happening on the fly. It was very clear what the meeting would be. Another person that served as a mentor for me, coincidentally, today we had a conversation and we booked a meeting for next week. And when I was booking the calendar, I was clear to put the agenda of the things that we would be talking about. So even though it was supposed to be a catch-up meeting because we had not spoken for almost 7 months, I was very clear to say, okay, we'll meet at so-so place. This is what we're going to be talking about. And if you have any other thing that you would want us to talk about, kindly add to this. And I think that helps to just really, you know, help formalize your conversations, especially when you're dealing with a coach or a mentor that is of the opposite sex.
Yeah. Those are great words. Thank you so much. And all to say that even if you dress properly and do all of that, some people will still take advantage of you.
Absolutely.
So know when to, like, you know, pivot and run for safety, okay? Don't put yourself in a dangerous position. But I loved how you emphasized you setting the tone, right? And documentation. Oh, wow. Like, this is key. Like, for me, and this is how I also behave with my mentors, like, or even coaches. You summarize the meeting, send it to them, and highlight the things you're supposed to do. So by the time you meet the next time, you're doing a recap. Oh, last time we met, we talked about this and this. This is what I've done with all the feedback you've given. Nothing makes a relationship sweeter than that. You know?
Absolutely.
You're managing their time well. You're managing your time well. And if you've been on the other side of mentoring people, there's something that's satisfactory about just seeing them grow, because you take pride in that achievement. I mean, they should be proud of themselves, but knowing that you were part of that process, even just a tiny bit, I think that satisfaction is what keeps it going. So let's talk about your journey into entrepreneurship as a way. But before then, you started working, you know, in other capacities. So walk us through your career trajectory, how you started, your very first job, and how you got to where you are today.
So I started off as a salesperson in Procter & Gamble as a key account manager.
Oh, they've left Nigeria now, right?
What did you say?
P&G, they've left Nigeria, right?
Yes.
Oh, sadly.
Yeah. Right now, they don't operate from Nigeria.
Yeah,
But I started off as a key account manager and, you know, managing a business in Lagos. And afterwards, I moved to the East, still as a key account manager, but this time around, I was working in about 12 states. And then shortly after that, I got promoted. So most of my career before I started working for Irede Foundation was with Procter & Gamble. I only worked for P&G. I worked for P&G for 13 years,
wow.
2 years and 14 years, including my, internship with Procter & Gamble.
Wow.
So I left that assignment, and after, you know, being a key account for about 3 years or so, I got promoted. I became a regional manager, and I was still managing the Eastern business. I did that for a bit. Then I, moved back to Lagos. And when I moved back to Lagos, I did an assignment called distributor operations. So it's more like a multifunction, working with a multifunctional team as a salesperson. So as a salesperson, I was working with people in logistics, finance, HR, different departments, and working with this set of guys to help deliver for the sales team. I did that for around 2 years, and then I left that assignment and became the e-commerce leader, the first e-commerce leader for Procter & Gamble West Africa. So I did that for a bit also. Then I did a broadening assignment. So I left sales and went into marketing and did a marketing role for another 9 months thereabout. Then I came back as a market strategy and planning leader for oral care. So I did oral care as market strategy and planning leader. Then I did baby care. And after doing baby care, I went back again to do some assignment for e-commerce. And at that point, I really felt like, you know, and e-commerce was, very interesting. Just going back to e-commerce. Then I now did modern trade. Modern trade is like the big stores. So I worked with the big five then in Nigeria. My assignment started winding down, and I decided to, by this time, I'd made up my mind that I wanted to leave, and had a conversation with my manager at the time, about 6 months, 1 year, 6 months to leaving, to letting her know that I would want to be, you know, exiting the company. And, so I basically just tidied up my assignment around modern trade, and then I left.
It's funny how you can condense 14 years of your life in like less than 5 minutes and make it seem like, oh yeah, it happened just, you know, 1 minute and then 1 minute later. But this is like a lifetime. Okay. So I have some follow-up questions for you. How does someone go from being a biochemistry major to account manager? Because I imagine you probably did your NYSC and then you got retained. But were there some skills you had to acquire to bridge that gap between what you knew and what you didn't know?
Absolutely. When I joined Procter & Gamble, the first thing that happened, so, I mean, Procter & Gamble has this interesting way of hiring you. It doesn't matter the cost that you do. The interview process kind of looks at the skills that you have, the potential that you have, and where they think you will thrive. So I had two options then, you know, either to go to the plants because I'm a biochemist and, you know, work in the lab, or sales. And I remember that the sales leader at the time was so sure that he wanted to hire me as a talent because he felt like I would do well. And one clear example was when I was in University of Lagos, I actually started a business. So I started a business while I was in Procter & Gamble because that was when cell phones just came into Nigeria and all of that. So I was doing the GSM business and it was really one clear example that I shared. So for him, if you as a student could start a business that was thriving, and at the time that I was having that interview, my business was still running. And so he was very clear that these were skills that were transferable that I could use. In Procter & Gamble. So when I joined P&G, I had to go through sales training. I mean, you don't just get into the company. You're trained consistently, for lack of a better word. It's almost like formed into the image.
Into the image of the company.
Yeah, I expected to be. So just really going through all of those trainings helped me because I learned different ways of selling. And so for every assignment that I got in P&G, whether it was working as a key account, a regional account manager, there were trainings that were specific to helping me lead in the different roles, you know, that I was taking on and different learnings that I had to do. So yes, so that's helped with the transitioning and the shift, that I had to make. So the trainings that I got, the personal, learnings that I had to take on, because it wasn't just learning on the job and things that just pertain to the job. It was also having to take up leadership skills because doing those different assignments, I had to work with people.
People management.
I was working with, you know, staff of Procter & Gamble that reported to me directly. I was working with the, you know, external people like our distributors and their staff. There was a time I was managing over 200 people.
What? You know,
And leading that team of over 200 people for the distributor. So that's huge. And there are skills that are needed, for those roles. So I had to learn. I had to, and those learnings were not just the things that I was learning from Procter & Gamble, but things that I had to acquire, myself.
Now, when you were rolling off all the things you did, so you started with being a account manager, a regional manager, distribution operators, and then you did e-commerce leader, and then marketing, and then baby care, oral care, e-commerce, and then modern trading, and I'm like, wow. And then, you know, said, I was winding down, and I needed to go. What were the things that went on inside of you that made you realize that, all right, we should start closing the curtains in this place?
While I was working with P&G, I gave birth to my daughter and she had a congenital deformity and her leg had to be amputated. And so, we can't probably talk about everything here, but that also affected the kind of assignments that I took. And I couldn't move around as much. So I moved from the East to Lagos and when I moved to Lagos, I should have moved to Lagos like a year before, but I couldn't make that move because of family. So I had to stay back in the East. But eventually I made a move to Lagos and my family had to move to Lagos also. And so when I get back to my daughter, again, that spark of just wanting to help people. First, I had a lot of questions. How am I going to deal with a child with disability? Who has done it before? How did they manage it? Is there even anyone that has done this before in Nigeria? So for me, I had a lot of questions. And in trying to get answers to those questions, that gave birth to starting off first and initiate. First, I started blogging. I started writing about,
experiences. You
know, parenting a child with disability and my experiences and the things that I was going through. And then, you know, that led to starting the foundation. And when I started the foundation, I was still working. I worked 3 years. I eventually joined Irede fully 3 years after it started. So I was doing that and I was doing my day job. I would go for, you know, global convenings, go for meetings. I'm in at different events, speaking, talking about disability, but I was working for Procter & Gamble. So there was so much that my annual leave days could do for me. There was so much time off that my boss could give me. And so at that point, after doing it for about 3 years, I knew that it was time to focus on something, because my heart was more now towards the foundation and working with these children and helping them live a full life. And, you know, really just seeing all the things that are transformable in the disability world. And that's how, you know, I knew that I had to wind down whatever it is that I was doing.
Okay. We'll segue into Irede soon, but I had a question for you about your, so when did you get married, by the way? And just tell us a little bit about how you met your husband, and then you can.
I got married in 2008. I met my husband in the East while I was working, you know, in the East. And, a friend had brought him to my house. Like, you know, you need to meet this girl. She's full of life and all of that. So my husband came to my house, with my friend, who is his elder brother, by the way. And, you know, we got talking, and he said the whole time he was just looking at me. He said, why is she everywhere? I'm just all jumpy and just all everywhere. I'm like, I don't like
this girl. She's still like that, guys, by the way.
I don't like this girl. Why is she all over the place? And I was thinking, where's this guy that is so cocky? Why is he just full of himself? You know, I'm used to having people around me that have a lot of life. They are vibrant. You know, as I'm giving my vibe,
reciprocating. Yeah,
he's just all so calm and everywhere. But interestingly, we became close friends, and we would, you know, gist and talk and all of that. And finally, that led to us getting married, because we just said, you know, we're friends.
Yeah,
we're, you know, we think we can make it work. So that's how I met my husband. I met him in Enugu, and you know, we got married in 2008, had Beulah in 2009, and we've been married, I think, over 17 years this year.
Yeah, I know it's a long time because I couldn't do math in my head. You know, longer than most Hollywood marriage years. So congrats on that, by the way. And another thing is that your husband is also from the eastern part of Nigeria, right? So you're intercultural marriage,
which I am.
How's that going? Do you speak Igbo, by the way?
I try. I could do better.
But you can understand it when people say some things and all that.
Some things, maybe like greetings, but nothing too much.
Yeah. And at face value, someone can just think you're Igbo, by the way. I'm sure you get that a lot.
Igbo, right?
First name too, you know, Crystal, you know, you hardly find Yoruba people bearing that first name. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now let's talk about Beulah, right? I mean, just going to your page and just the things you do, your personal page and your Irede page, she's all over it. You can just tell. Even when I came to your office, you know, I could see a picture of her. And I think I have so many things to say about that, but I think it's a beautiful thing that what you struggled with at first, you found a way not just to navigate that and shine through that, but also created pathways for millions of children and people, you know, for what you do, which I think is really amazing. And the impact is not just what we're talking about now. When I talk about millions of children, I'm also considering the future impact you're going to have. Mm. But let's just start with your pregnancy and looking back now and the questions you had when you were told, oh, your child is going to have to go through this surgery. And that was your first child, right? Your first time being a mom. Oh, my goodness. So maybe just walk us through as best as you can fit it into a very short, you know, podcast. But what were thoughts that were going through your head, and how dare you just think of, let me see what I can do, not just to help myself, but to help other people. Again, going back to what you said about your family values.
Mo, I didn't even start off trying to help anybody. I wanted to help I was so devastated. having my first child, you know, disability. I don't know. Let me say it in Yoruba. Yoruba is my dialect. And
yeah,
then
I can help. Yeah.
You know, all that conversation of Kosini no Yoruba, we've never heard
it. It's not in our generation. Yeah. Yeah. And
so there were so many words, so many people were saying so many things.
Hey.
I was so devastated. Plus, I'm a person of faith. I'm like, how can God be looking at me?
I not even give you a warning or hint.
Even warning. I'm saying, see, oh, this is going to happen. Because I did have scans and stuff when I was pregnant, and they never detected it. So, I was so devastated. I didn't think that anything good could come out of giving birth to a child with disability.
Especially in that part of the world. And it's not your problem. It's not your fault, really. Because we don't have a lot of infrastructure. We don't even have Disabilities Act. You know, they're seen as less than.
We now have a Disability Act.
But is it implemented everywhere? What I mean, implementation,
no,
like
implemented
cramps,
everywhere.
Schools.
No.
Exactly. Exactly.
Everywhere.
Public spaces. Schools, you know. Yeah, that's what I meant. Sorry, I meant implementation. Anybody can write an act, but is it implemented everywhere?
So implementation is still in progress. Anyways.
But yeah, well, thank God there's an act. Yay. Win.
Gradually, I think one of the things that was very clear was God told me, I'm going to take care of her. Told my husband, I'm going to take care of her. I'm like, what does that even mean? Taking care of her means the leg should grow out.
You were so mad that God had to tell your husband.
And so at some point, you know, I felt like the 2 years of waiting to make a decision was the grooming years for me. God was building me up, feeding me, just letting me know that I wasn't alone. Things were going to be good. I was reading up. I was researching. I was seeing other people having the same kind of condition and how they've been able to live life. And so, though not in Nigeria, people outside the country. So, but it was a glimmer of hope, right? And then at some point, one day, it was almost like God just woke me up and said, it's time. And I started writing. I wrote and wrote and wrote different things that were possible and, you know, that could be done. But still, I wasn't thinking of a foundation until I met a woman who had given birth to her son with a congenital deformity also, but of the upper hand. And so for me, talking her through, helping her get a life and all of that was like the roadmap God needed to give me for me to start off and start, you know, beginning to build Irede Foundation. And so that's how I transited from, you know, somebody that was going through her own pain and her issues to the other people that are going through the same, that cannot afford to take care of their own children by providing them with artificial limb. And so I'm like, it won't be a bad idea to just give one child a limb. So I wasn't thinking of 1,000 more like you are, or millions.
It was just start with one. But look at the impact that's had, right?
But just one child.
Yeah,
it was just, if one child can smile again, if one child can have hope, if a family, and one child today, over 600 limbs given.
Wow. I mean, for, by the way, congratulations on all of the strides you've made with that. And also to Bella as well, whose life and life as well has, you know, shaped so many other lives. Now, you talked about sharing, you know, with other people and finding that community. I can't even imagine how hard it is, because in our part of the world, not many people with these kind of problems want to talk about it. As a matter of fact, they are more likely to hide these children behind doors. And not because they are being mean, because the society at large is getting better. But growing up, I remember I had a neighbor whose child was, now they would say maybe was on a spectrum, but was severely disabled. And we never saw her playing outside. You know, you just catch a glimpse. They were always locked her in the house and you hear her screaming and shouting. And the child would later pass on. But I felt for the parents, it was just a lot of stress. And they didn't have a lot of support externally for that. So my question for you would be this. How do you, I mean, we live in an age now where everything detail stays on the internet forever for perpetuity, right? And there's that fear of sharing too much about, you know, your child. I think it was a blogger that I followed who has stopped showing, you know, their children online. And she said she had gone to a store one day with her son, who she had shared a lot about, you know, I didn't used to follow her a lot, so I didn't know what she had shared about her son. Maybe just something really a bit embarrassing, but was cute. And then someone saw them at the checkout line and just mentioned it to the son. Oh, do you used to do this, you know, and the child was looking at mom like, mom, like, how come this person knows about me? And it was that shock in her face that made her realize that, wow, I was doing this just out of, you know, sharing, but then I can now see the impact it's having on my child. And since then, she says she never, you know, she stopped sharing. But yours is a little bit different. But I'm just curious to know, for those who might be in that pickle, why do you want to share? But how do you navigate that balance between sharing your child's journey, especially when there's a disability, to build awareness and community, while also protecting their privacy and honoring their autonomy?
Thank you very much. So one of the things that I learned very early, even before the amputation of the limb was done, was to talk to Biola about it. Mm. So even though she was a child, we talked to her about it. Secondly, as much as possible, I try not to share Biola's story because I don't know Biola's story, but I know my own story. Mm. So I've had people ask me questions, what does it feel like to, you know, be amputated and all of that. And I say, I'm not an amputee. I genuinely don't know what it feels like. I've never been in Biola's shoes, but I know what it feels like to be Biola's mom. So what I try to do is share the story from my perspective and what I know. Thirdly, Biola is a grown teenager now. And so each time her story needs to be told, question is, you know, run it by her and really ask her, is this something you want to talk about? Is it okay? So if you really follow the trend of Irede's story or even any of the children, we really don't share their story in the light of the way we see it. No, it is what they want to share, what they want to say, but we share from the perspective of carers and supporters. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good balance, for anyone that is working with a child or you want to share other people's story. You need to find an ethical way of sharing that story and putting dignity into it. So I remember once someone was asking me, why don't you share, when you share the pictures of the children at the foundation, they are, you know, great pictures, they look very good and all of that. I said, because that we are making champions of child amputees. So I don't want to tell a gory story. I don't want to show you them looking really horrible. I want to show you what it is that giving hope can do. So it's a picture of a champion because that's who they are. And we just putting it in that light for the world to see. So I think if one is able to create that fine balance between telling your story ethically and really asking yourself the question, 10, 20 years down the line, if I see this story of me, how would I feel? And once you've answered that question genuinely, you are likely to share, you know, stories of the children, of the people that you work with, whether they are women, men, whatever it is, in a different way. So if you go to our social media page, the Irede social media page, we evolved from, you know, putting out pictures of the children as we fundraise, to now talking about it after the child has gotten their limb and all of that. Yeah. I think over the last 13 years, we built credibility to show that what it is that we say we're going to use the funds for, we will definitely use it for it. So we also follow PII. We don't just share stories. We try to keep the identity of the child. So I'm not going to say Crystal Chibu is the child I'm dealing with. I'm likely to say it's Crystal C because there are probably plenty Crystal C's.
C out there,
And so we have different ways in which we protect the identity of these children, but we only tell their stories as champions.
And I think you also forgot to mention your cartoons, you know, using those animated characters to anthropomorphize, you know, the stories in the children's stories in a creative way to build awareness and community while also protecting their identity and privacy. All right. Thank you. Thank you. So, I reviewed a proposal 2 years ago, and so For context, I do this volunteer work with college boards, AP boards, yeah, advanced placement. Students in high school who want to test out and get college credits beforehand, they have an opportunity to do research tracks when they're in high school. And so they do they take AP seminars and AP research, and part of their ways to like get those credits to be to write a thesis proposal. One of the things I had read was a student who, a high schooler, you know, blew my mind, who did 3D models for building 3D limbs, like parts and all that for different kind of things. And he talked about how in the, and I'm correct me if I'm saying this wrong, but in the world of, you know, amputation and all that, there's so many moving parts and there's a lot of waste because the children grow up, when they are growing, the things don't grow with them. So there's so much things that you have to like keep throwing out and then fixing. And this student, because I don't know whether it's a female or a male, we never gender the kids. They talked about how because of that moving parts that doesn't move, it was imperative that the weight bearing portion, especially what connects two parts together, we can reduce the waste by building models that can, the materials can grow with the, and it's the first time I realized that when I think about amputees and, you know, prosthetics, I think about just one thing that just stays. But no, it's several things that you have to, you know, worry for. And then also making sure it's clean, it's not one that can give them infections. And I can't even imagine in your part of the world where, you know, there's not like a robust infrastructure in place. Imagine if you didn't have the knowledge and the resources. And I imagine it was also very draining because that's a lot. You know, if you're paying out of pocket for all of these things, what things you learned early on, especially with prosthetics, that you can like to recycle to parents who might be in that position right now and are struggling with trying to find resources and how to support their children?
So I realized that the first thing is there are things that are reusable. So like that child, well, that person that did the research said, so there are things that are reusable and there are things that are non-reusable. So you have foot that, you know, someone else has used that you can reuse. There's something called a pylon that, you know, someone else has used that can be reused. There are knee joints that someone has used that can be reused if, you know, it's properly used. And so with that, one of the key things that I think that is possible to do is to see how to, especially for us as a foundation, we keep recycling the things that are recyclable. You talked about, and it's interesting because I'm like, okay, she's a pharmacist. So one of the key things that I also realized, especially for us in Africa, because of the tropical nature and, a heat and all of that. So in other climes, liners work for them perfectly. For us, liners do not really work. It gives contact dermatitis. So we use more of the storm socks, and storm socks are cheaper. And they are reusable. So for anyone that has a child and your child is using prosthesis, please get storm socks. Put in the socket for the child. And so just like you're changing your clothes, you can always change that and wash it. And then it dries and you reuse it another time. So you can have like 2-3 storm socks. And for every use, you can wash and put back. And that can actually help save money. And then thirdly, stay within a community. Trust. There are so many things that you cannot do by yourself or even teach your child on how to use. Even though I worked in the, you know, in the prosthetic space for over 8 years, 9 years at the time, COVID gave me a different knowledge of the people that I was working with, because I only thought more of the lower limb amputees, just for me to realize that there were so many things the upper limb amputees could not do, including washing their hands. And remember during COVID, we were told to wash our hands, your hands. Like, but these guys, how do you use one hand to wash no hand? And so they couldn't. And it was the first time it was occurring to me that some of them could not even wear shirts and, you know, button their shirts or even scrub their own bodies. And that gave a different light. So, and that only happened because of the community that we belonged to at the time and someone really sharing their experience and how they were able to manage it. So I think one of the things that will help parents within the space to manage their budgets is belonging to a community, because you will learn so many things from the things that other people have actually done and worked and how they've used, they've been able to manage, so you don't repeat the same mistakes.
Okay. Just quickly follow up with that. How do you find this community? How did you find your community?
I created a community. There was a community at the time when I started. So I created. But I would say first, my community started with my friends. Some of those friends started with them. Because they were the community at the time. Family and my friends were my community. And then gradually, I realized that there was no disability community for parents of children that have been amputated. And so I created one. And from time to time, we increase because people someone sees another person and then they invite them to come and join the community, or you're talking to them and all of that. So sometimes those community already exists, and that's the beauty of the internet. You can always research on the internet and you will find them. But where there is none, create one.
So we've talked about, thanks a lot, we talked about just the physical parts of it and the modifications we've had to do, but we're yet to address the mental, aspect of it, especially for you and your husband as first time parents. How did you navigate just all of that hurdle? And permit me to just assume that being a first time mom, were there some guilt you had as to maybe something I did or something I didn't eat or I didn't say, or you crossed over somebody used evil eyes, things like that, people just speculate around you.
Absolutely.
How did you navigate the mental, aspect of that diagnosis?
It was guilt. It was also the socialization around us at the time, because disability was not talked about and it wasn't fashionable or something anybody wanted to do. So, like I said, it's not in our generation. So people talked down and, stereotyped and discriminated even against us. There were people that didn't want their children to interact with us, at the time. But I would say the first thing that worked for us, our faith. We consistently had to go back to the source of our strength to get it. And, usually when I'm talking to people, I tell them, you might not be of the Christian faith, but there's something that, you need to keep going back to help you, hold you, keep you strong, from time to time, so that you can live and lead a good life. And for me, it was my faith first. Secondly, the way I dealt with it, friends, still going back to a community that I could always, break down before and share with on what it is that I'm going through. And, they were there, and able to manage. In fact, I got into grief recovery because of the experience that I'd gone through and what happened to me, and just wanting to help other people get out of it. Because the journey of having a child with disability is different. It's very unique. Yeah. So that community is very helpful also. So from time to time, I get back to them to be able to get the kind of strength and help that I needed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I think finally, I had to have faith in myself. And believing that I was going to do well through it all. And I just knew that there was no staying down with this one. It's either up or up. I didn't have any other option. My only option was to look up. I wasn't going to look down on this particular one. I was just going to help myself get there. If you know Nigeria very well, at that time, 13 years ago, mental health was not a thing. So there was really nobody to really talk to and say, I'm going through some mental health issues. Like I said, I was devastated. I was all crying and all of that. I'm an Acumen Fellow. And one of the things that I clearly learned while I was in that community also was the fact that, it was okay for some things. It was okay to cry. It was okay to be sad, because what was going on with me was the third one. And so having those things and having to deal really helped. But mostly it was my faith. It was
right?
Me, the person mm-hmm. looking up, and then mm-hmm. it was my community and network that helped me through and helped us through really the challenging time of the mental issues that could have arisen. Oh, so I remember when Beulah's leg, the day it was amputated, for instance, we were not alone in the hospital. Our friends came around. They stayed with us from morning till she went into surgery and came out of surgery and was wheeled into the hall. And I remember that, you know, when she woke up, their children that were her age, all at the hospital to let her know that she was not by herself. I don't think there's anything else, you know, that could be bigger than that kind of support that help you realize you'll navigate through irrespective of whatever it is you go through.
Wow. And how old was she when she had the surgery?
She was 2 years and 3 months.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that. And I love how you called it grief, because I think so many of us, when we think about grief, we think about it has to be associated with death. But grief can be in a spectrum, right? Mourning the loss of what you thought was supposed to be a normal, you know, pathway, but it's still normal, but it's just a different pathway. And still calling it grief, I think it makes a lot of sense. Okay. Now let's talk about the business. You went from all of that fancy things at P&G. You left your 9-to-5, secure salary. You now started doing foundation, sister. And then with your daughter and everything that was going on, how did you do it? How did you overcome that fear of which paycheck is coming out this month? I know NGOs in Nigeria, said that way back then it was hustling game, you know, not so much.
We're still hustling,
but there's hustle and there's hustle. Then in the beginning, it's like, who's doing NGO? Now it's a bit cooler than it used to be, but it's still hustling, right? But how did you do it?
I think the first thing that happened was, I had 1 year to think about the fact that I was going to do my job. 1 year. 1 year of talking to my boss. 1 year of trying to convince my husband it was the best decision that I was taking for myself. 1 year of convincing myself that I wouldn't have to run back. So in that 1 year, really, there was a lot of strategizing and trying to see. And so even though I know that the strategy did not work like that per se, but, you know, strategizing and saying this is what I wanted to do and this is how I was going to go about it. So that 1 year really helped. The fact that I also had my partner supporting me through the journey, because I wasn't on the salary for a bit. So he was the one, you know, and really still now, you know, when I look at him and I'm like, I'm bringing something to the table. At least if somebody is bringing 95% and you are bringing 5%, it's still something to the table. So he's still basically. And all of that. But somebody was taking care of the bills helped me to be able to structure and say how would this pan out. I think that's the first thing. The second thing, we talked earlier about my coach, was also sitting down and really saying how is this going to work out. It was okay not to be paid a salary for a period of time. And then when, you know, would I start getting paid a salary? What are the other things that I was going to do to sustain myself if this was not going to be able to sustain me? So again, we went through that motion and I had to answer all of those questions, and that was very helpful. And then very quickly, we started structuring the foundation in terms of what were our sources of income or revenue? How were we going to fund the foundation? So it started first with friends and family. Then we started extending to getting corporate donors, you know, applying for grants. And to the point right now where we're beginning to think of trust, because we have earned income that comes as a result of trust funds that we've put in place, that keeps coming back to be able to take care of the operations of the foundation. So just putting in that structure and being able to think about, you know, what we want to do in the next 1 year, what we want to do in the, you know, medium term, and then in the long term as an organization, has really been very helpful to getting to the point right now where we are. I won't say we are comfortable, but a lot better from when we started 13 years ago, because that has now helped us to stabilized. So I would say first, it was really just thinking through and writing down, saying this is what we're going to do. The second thing basically is we getting to the point where we started to structure the organization and have so the board in place, you know, the different things that give us credibility as an organization. And then now just thinking of sustenance going forward, I would say it's that path where we are on now.
Congratulations on 3 years. What's the average life cycle of an NGO in Nigeria, by the way?
I think they said it's 3 to 5 years or so.
I thought so too. So congrats on scaling that over. And it's not just an NGO. It's an NGO that has, you know, implication for lives, like literally, right? And the families you're impacting. And if anything, they shouldn't last that long. But you have, you know, stood the test of it. And I can't imagine it's been a walk in the park. What would you say are some of the ways, some of the things you say have sustained your foundation till now? 13 years, that's a legacy.
Governance.
What does that mean?
Corporate governance. So having a board in place that decides on, you know, gives strategic direction as to what we're going to do as an organization. Being transparent. I mean, if you go on our website, you will see the audited financial statements. It's out there. It's just out there. So you can see from the year we started up until, you know, our 2023 audited financial statements. We're not done 2024 audits yet. It's just really out there. So I would say that, transparency, it helps with credibility. That's the second thing. Third thing, just really focusing on your mission. I've had people suggest different things to us as an organization on what it is that we think, what is going to sell per se. But, you know, just really focusing on the reason why we started and always going back to it, because sometimes different things come up that want to derail you or change your focus and your vision. And I would say finally, for me, it's the champions. They keep us going. Notice I don't call them beneficiaries because they're not
champions. So
for every day another one comes on board, I know I have to do more work. I know there is a reason for me to wake up, basically, because they're the reason why I do this.
They keep going. Wow. I love that. Governance, transparency, and corporate governance and transparency. Those are big ones that I think we need to learn as people, especially business owners in our part of the world, because this is a standard you set. It's not like you have an IRS that is coming over you and all that. We don't have a lot of that structure in place that kind of clamps down on NGOs and how they misappropriate funds, because we know that happens everywhere, you know. But when you have laws in place where we don't have a lot of that being implemented in our part of the world, it takes you trying to be separate and also be intentional to say that this is our values and we're going to stick to it. And I thank you so much for sharing that. Now, you spent a lot of time with PNG, you know, about 14 years, including your internship years. Having worked for an MNC in that capacity before starting your own foundation, and I feel like you've already answered this question, but I just wanted to tease that out, because one of our guests, Chris, mentioned that when he relocated to Canada, one of the things he intentionally did was to go work for somebody for a few years, because he just didn't want to take his business and his money and then say he's just going to start a business. He wanted to learn the know-hows. This climate is different from Nigeria. I can't be so foolish enough to say I know everything and just start all of a sudden. So for him, it was intentional. For you, you came upon PNG, but you realized, okay, it's time for me to leave. But I imagine that when you left, you didn't just leave everything behind. What were some of the skills from your corporate career that were transferable and has helped you succeed in this nonprofit space you're in?
Collaborations. I've learned that, you know, you can't do it by yourself. And I learned that in PNG. Building and sustaining relationships. In fact, I dare to say that you can't run a nonprofit if you don't know how to sustain strategic partnerships or relationships. And that I learned from PNG. If you remember our conversation, I talked about the fact that I led modern trade, I did e-commerce, yes. I worked with distributors, and all of this is just working with people. So you have to learn the skill of sustaining those relationships, working with them when it is good and when it is bad. So that's another skill that I would say I learned. I learned to self-discipline from PNG. So PNG would talk about, you know, operating with discipline, following through and all of that. All of this I learned from, you know, working in the corporate environment, because some days I don't just want to show up. Some days I want to sleep a bit more, but I remember that my commitment, you know, in my word is my bond. So I wake up and I just show up at work. I remember my boss used to tell me 50% of the job gets done when you show up. And that never
just showing up. Wow.
Yeah, just showing up. You have done 50% of the work. So come to work. Don't sit back at home. So I think that's really helpful. And I only learned that while I was working in a corporate environment and working with other people. I think the diversity also of just working with people from different races, different, you know, ethnic backgrounds, gender, you know, religious background also has really helped with, you know, leading the foundation, because today we give limbs across Nigeria. And so you have children from different ethnic backgrounds, gender and all of this. I remember one of someone that worked here talking about safeguarding and the fact that, you know, when we're working with female children, there is a way that we should relate. And so that is really guiding the safeguarding principles of how it is that we work, you know. And those are some of the things. It's a lot, you know, that I learned documentation from working in a corporate environment. And so today, putting those things in place and trying to do it on a day-to-day basis, or even setting up the different departments and the work that we do is something that, you know, I learned from working in the multinational. Is there so much more to still learn and do? Yes, especially because things are evolving. I mean, 14 years ago, I've worked for Iredia now over 9 years. It's a lot of things have changed. Digital world, things are a lot different. And, you know, for me, I think one thing that I would say I learned from there that I've transferred is to just keep evolving, is to be agile. Not to stay on your onions and think you know it, but just always think of how to evolve, be flexible, learn what's new and jump on it, and see how to use it to continue to foster the work that you do.
And the world is so accessible right now. Gone are those days when we didn't have, like, you know, internet and AI. So yeah, I love how just be agile, like just get on it. Now, you've talked a lot about the champions you work with. Because I also imagine that it's not just them, but it's also the family. You get to know about the dynamics. Which, I think for me, even thinking about it, I'm getting emotional. How do you, like, what would you say has been the most emotional or difficult story you've encountered while working with your champions? And how do you safeguard your heart from not getting too overwhelmed with the emotionality of it all? I'd like to know that.
All the work, all the stories are emotional. I don't think that there is one story of amputation that is less emotional than any other story. So I'd rate all the stories on the same level, because they have their own uniqueness, really. But I know that just really thinking of them, even now, just as I want to give you one story, I remember another story. So the stories are really unique and really heart-wrenching when you listen to the reasons why these limbs are either amputated, or either they are congenital, or those that, you know, have it as a result of trauma. But how do I safeguard my heart? I think the first thing is realizing that there is hope, irrespective. It's one safeguard, because I know that there is a solution. I know that there is light at the end of the tunnel. So I listen with empathy versus sympathy. I don't stay in the pain and the rigor of it. I'm asking myself, what's the way out? So for every time I'm talking to a parent, I'm talking to a new amputee, the question I'm asking is, what's our way out? And sometimes you don't see that way out when you're talking to the family, because you know, it's probably a really very tragic story or different things, but I'm still asking because I know there is always a way out. So I give you a point, and I'm not going to be sharing anybody's story. I'm going to be sharing my own story. I remember when when Beulah first got her prosthetic limb, and it had a belt around it. And usually, if you check globally, when every time they produce a prosthetic limb, they are likely to put a belt, especially when the amputation is above the knee or above the elbow.
To help secure.
To help secure it. Okay. So and also to help the confidence of the amputee to ensure that it doesn't just fall off, because it can fall off. Mm. Yeah. And so my daughter had a belt around hers, and she had been potty trained, but every time she uses it, before she could get the belt out, then, you know, it's late. And I remember sitting with the prosthetist and saying, there has to be a way out. And he says, no, everywhere globally, go and research. They put belts around this thing. And I'm like, no, we can invent something that is going to work for the child. Mm. And that's how, you know, what led to an invention of the prosthetic, kind of prosthetic limb that we actually use for the children, even when they are above the knee amputees right now, and they not having belts around their prosthetic limb. For some that are a little bit, you know, almost a hip de-articulation, we use a belt to secure, because there's really nothing holding onto the stump. But I'm just saying, for me, it's not staying in the moment of that pain. And while you're talking about it, I'm already asking myself, what's the way out? I'm saying, God, what's the way out for this? What's the way out? What's the uniqueness of this champion? Sometimes it's not even, the uniqueness is not in providing an artificial limb. It's probably that, you know, the psychosocial support that this family needs.
It probably is
just that, you know, you just need to help them see that it's possible. So again, that helps me not to stay in the place of my pain, and quickly evolve and ask what the question is. But are the stories heart-wrenching? Yes, they are. And like I said, there's none that more newsworthy than others. They're just all as unique as they come.
Thanks for sharing that. And I love how you emphasize the difference between sympathy and empathy. Not that one is more superior than the other. Of course, I prefer empathy, but knowing when to use it. Because sympathy is just like, you know what, I feel for you. And that's just it, acknowledging the feelings from the outside. But empathy takes it from, I feel with you. How can we get to that solution together, right? And so thanks for doing that. Now, as we wrap up, I had some curiosity questions for you. So for this, we've talked about the prosthetics and the people that you work with. Where are they sourced from, and what kind of materials do they use to make sure that they last longer and the people using them, your champions using them, they feel very secure in them?
So today we source from, I would say across the world, from Germany, from China, from Turkey, different places, actually. And really right now we are hopeful that we are going to be able to make our own sockets and probably make some prosthetics using the 3D printers very, very soon, because we're doing some research work and hoping to get some donations that that help us to be able to acquire the materials to use that. For Irede, we produce modular prostheses for the children. So there are different kind of prostheses. You have the Japaw foot, you have, you know, and to the very high-tech ones like the bionics, but we use what is called modular prostheses, and especially because we keep changing the prosthetics for the child until the child is 18. So as they grow, keep changing. We initially would, I mean, depending on the activity level of the child and the type of amputation, we will probably give what is called a sash foot, which is just basic foot that you can get, to carbon foot, which have hydraulics that helps the children with the bounce and help them to do very well. So it depends. We just really look at what the child needs per time. And so if you're just coming in as a fresh amputee, we are likely to give you a sash foot, help create a balance for you. And then as the child is growing, and we're thinking of all the activities that they will be involved with, then we start giving them carbon foot, start doing hydraulics, you know, high-tech knee joints that help them to do a lot more
around,
just the basics.
Wow. So I imagine that when they're 18 and at that point they've stopped growing as much, you don't have to have a lot of moving parts and they can just take it from there.
Absolutely.
There's so much I don't know. There's so much I don't know about this world. So you've been doing this for a while now. I'm just curious to know about the government involvement, because when you talked about sourcing parts from Germany, Turkey, are there not places locally that can do this for you? And what has your involvement been with the Nigerian government in supporting what you do?
Today, as a country, we're not producing, locally. So what we do is we assemble the parts. Mm-hmm. However, things like the socket. So there's something called a socket where you build what is formed around the stump. That is made locally. So again, because most of that is made from, resins and POP materials and all of that we are able to do in-house. In terms of working with the government, one of the key things that we've done is a lot of advocacy in ensuring that there are policies to support the children so that they can go to school. The Act talks about equal and equitable education for all. So it's making sure that our own children also have access to education. So that's much of what we've done. In terms of with respect to the components and all, we don't even have the technology to manufacture here. But one of the key things that we've done is the covering for the prosthetic limbs, because again, in developed world, you will see that a lot of people don't cover their prosthetics. So if it's robotics, you see everything that is inside. Yeah. But here, to help manage people's mental health, to help them manage acceptance and culture and everything, we cover with a skin-like cover. And we have a lot of leather in Nigeria. So we get leather in-house, in Nigeria, I mean, to be able to do the covering. So that's like one major component that we have. We're hoping that in the next 5 years, we'll have our research lab where we're able, I talked to you about the 3D printing.
Yeah.
Different kind of things that we begin to do as an organization. And as we focus on this, then I'm sure that engaging with government and seeing how to get rebates and probably things that they can help with will not be something that will be difficult at all.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I guess assembling and all the auxiliary parts like the leather and all that coverings, that's not a bad way to start. But this could also be a call out to anyone out there who has the expertise and the know-how to on how to locally produce this part, so that way it can be cheaper and more accessible. So this is just a way of just saying, please extend your expertise to Iridi Foundation and people in that space. Now, you have a comic book, right, with superheroes, and I think it's such an innovative idea. What inspired that, and how have the kids responded to those comic books you do?
Yes, so when our kids started going to school, you would hear some of them say, "Oh, my friends are laughing at me. They said they've never seen this leg before," and some were not even accepted in schools. And so, question for me was, how do you help these children know about different kind of disabilities and use them as your ambassador so they can educate their parents also? Because one of the issues that we have in Nigeria is the fact that culturally, disability is not accepted. So it almost is like as a taboo when somebody has a disability or you give birth to a child with disability. So I'm like, what way? Connect with kids. How do you connect with kids? They are the ones that read the cartoons and, and all the anime and all of that. So just probably, if we have a way to explain it to them in a language they will understand, then they become our advocates at the end of the day. Then, they can also educate other children, their parents, and their communities. Mm. And so that's how we started the comic books. And so we did the first one. And it's not in just writing the comic books to communicate issues of disability, but also social issues. So we looked at it at like a two-plunged approach to be able to get children to be educated, sensitized, and become ambassadors for us as we do the work.
I love that. Thanks for sharing that. And what better way to engage kids and even their family than through cartoons, you know? And I imagine that these kids who say all these things, they don't know any better. It's not like kids are like evil, you know? But when they know better and they are more aware and, you know, educated about what it's like to, you know, have these kind of challenges, they're also able to serve as advocates and campaign for their other friends as well. So thanks for sharing that. You've talked about the Disability Act and things that, you know, Nigeria has done. What's your ultimate vision for disability inclusion in Nigeria, and let's just say Africa as a whole? What do you think needs to change?
What needs to change?
Yeah.
How orientation of disability needs to change as a people.
Good luck with that. We have a long way to go. Yeah.
Yeah, that needs to change. But my vision is to see a Nigeria where, you know, persons with disabilities are treated equally, like they are typical, and they're able to get equal access to everything that their typicals have. So from education to employment to information, I mean, just name it, just having equal access. Where a person with disability will have equal pay as their typical, where a person with disability will have equal opportunity as their typical. I think that day I'll be ready to.
Okay. I know how you call it, how you say typical, you know. I like that. So Out on a Limb has reached, you know, millions of children and millions of lives. Let's just capitalize as that. Where do you see this movement going in the next 5 years?
I envision like a 1 million march happening where across the world, where everyone is standing up to work for child amputees and just equity. That would be fantastic. Today, you know, we're still hovering around having 1,000 to 2,000 people globally. And I just really feel like it can be massive. Like, just imagine having 1 million people standing up for child amputees. I think that would be fantastic.
I imagine that would be that as well. So you've talked about some of the skills that you brought from PNG to what you do. And I think you missed out the critical part of, which is the sales and marketing, because for you to be able to apply for grants and the partnerships you've done, you need to have been able to sell something and provide a vision, given that you don't have a lot of NGOs in this space. So for social entrepreneurs like you who are just starting out and they're still trying to, you know, figure things out, how can they make it work? You know, and what are some of the things?
Don't sell more. Everybody sells.
Everybody makes a sale like you, okay?
So fundraising, honestly, I think it's easy to fundraise when you have a reason, when you have a product. And I think he really has the unique product of this children, and I'm using the word product because I don't imagine that the people that are listening to me are just people, you know, with non-profits alone or even a social business alone. Whatever business that you have, you need to have a product that is sellable. And I think that unique product with the benefits of what they have, whether they are tangible or intangible, because at least when you look at the work that we do at Irede for our donors, it's very intangible. It almost is just like a feeling, like a feel-good
good feeling.
Thing. Of impact as you do the work that you do. Even though for some of them, there are things that they can touch because they have a reach to the number of people that we reach and all of that. And that is good for them, because then so many more people can buy their products, because they are giving back to child amputees. But you need to have that unique product. I think that's the first thing. It makes it easy to be able to sell. I think the second thing is you need to work at being known. People only buy what they know.
Brand reality. Yeah.
Well, now, not yet. We're not there yet. We're still working at it. You pay for what you know. When you get to the market and you want to buy something, if you don't know it, you can't. you can't buy the product. Yeah. The third thing will be that you want to, people to like you as a product. And we only like the people that are consistent, the people that show up constantly. So for you that you're trying to sell your product or you're trying to fundraise, I want to encourage you to basically work at being consistent at it. Recently, I was talking to someone. I was saying, today, you're selling pawpaw. Next tomorrow is apple. Next tomorrow is pounded yam. We don't know you for anything. It almost feels like you're... So, but if we consistently eat your jollof rice, and it is same taste, same, and it's that good, we will keep, coming back. And I think, finally, you need to get it to a place of trust. So if you say you're going to something, you do it. And that's, you know, I think we talked about it differently. It's the credibility, it's everything that shows that you're a product that can be trusted. And so when you bring all of this together, it then sells. And so you are able to easily talk about it. I think it's easy for us to go from using champions to raise funds to now not putting out the champions again, because over the last 13 years, if the consistency is there, the word of mouth is there, people that we have worked with, and so it's easier to just be able to sell. So I would say have your product, make it a valuable product, a value-driven product, things that connect with people. For those of us in the social space, it needs to connect to the heart of people. So it's not just generically talking about something, but it's that thing that people can connect with. And if it's a product that is not, you know, within the social space, make sure that it has great value. And then ensure that, you know, people get to know it. So if there's anybody listening to me this evening, one of the things that I would please like you to do is actually just follow Irede Foundation on all her social media handles. And it's at the Irede Foundation, because that's how people get to know us, you know, more and more. And then ensure that you're liked. Make sure that you're consistent. And finally, make sure that you can be trusted. Your product will sell.
Thank you. I mean, I could keep talking to you on and on, but I think we should cap it at this point. And you've actually answered half of what I wanted to ask you next. For those who want to get involved, so you've dropped your social media handles, which you're going to put on the in the show notes. But for potential investors or volunteering their time and maybe their resources or even donation, how can they reach out to you specifically?
I think the best way to reach out is our website. Our website is, you already said it with the caption, it's theiredefoundation.org. And there you will see how to get involved. So either as a volunteer, or you want to be a donor, or you just really want to be an advisor, or you want to join us and work for us, you will see all of those ways to get involved. And I think you captured it very well, Mo. It's, you can get involved by giving your time, that is volunteering. You can get involved by giving us your talent. You can get involved by giving us your treasure. So your money goes a long way to helping the children live a full life, impactful lives, you know, lives that are limitless, because then we're able to put all of it together, provide artificial limbs for them, pay for their education for those that cannot afford it, and continue to build a team that is sustainable for the future.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much. I mean, I have learned a lot from you today. And as we wrap up this conversation, I just want to say that one thing is abundantly crystal clear about you. Your journey is more than just that of a story of success. I think it's a testament to the power of purpose, of passion, of persistence. How you're able to transform that personal pain into a mission that has touched, you know, lives, uncountable lives. So even imagining how society sees and includes children with disabilities. Thank you for also reminding us that even though when you can't see the when you can't see the forest for the trees, begin with that step, you know, of love, of courage, of sharing, of unwavering faith, right? And I also think that your work through Irede Foundation is not just about providing prosthetic limbs or advocacy works. You are trying to restore, it's about restoring dignity and joy and hope to these children and families across Africa and Nigeria and beyond, because we know just how stigmatized disabilities can be in our community. Also rewriting the narrative of what is possible when a dream is met with determination and a community of believers. And I really thank you for emphasizing the importance of finding community. If there's not one, create one. So to everyone listening to us, we hope that Crystal's journey inspires you to believe that your voice, your efforts, and your heart can create those ripples of change. Whether you're an entrepreneur, a mom, or a guardian to someone that has a disability, or a student, or you're just someone that is simply moved by the needs you see around you. We hope that her work, you know, inspires you to be proud to also keep doing what you're doing to support, you know, the mission of those around you. And if you want to, you know, volunteer your time and your resources to Radio Foundation, you consider donating to them to support their mission in empowering children with disabilities and driving inclusion. So we encourage you to, our listeners, to join us, you know. Every contribution, no matter the size, will make a lasting difference. I would like to start that. So on behalf of the Mossible podcast, we're making a one-time $200 donation to your foundation. I would email, I'll have my assistant email you to work out just how we get that done. But yes, thank you so much. And to our listeners, you know, as you go about your day, ask yourself this question: what can I do, what I have, to leave the world a little better than I found it? Perhaps your pain point. I've said a lot about, you know, our experience with infertility and everything we've gone through. That has formed a lot of conversation, the communities we've built with women, and just, redefining what shame is like and helping people just live above all of this pain they've gone through. That has been my own story. And with Crystal's story of her child and not just hiding in that shame and in all of that pain, but see what has come to, you know, to pass in the past 13 years. So thank you, Crystal, for sharing your story, your wisdom, your heart with us. We can't wait to see how the Iridi Foundation continues to change lives and break barriers. And thanks a lot to Tosi Adesa of Indoor Foundation, Indoor Studios, for making this connection happen. I met with Crystal for the first time last month and I was so stoked. I was just fangirling. And yeah, so until next time, everyone, please take care and keep spreading light and joy wherever you go. Thank you so much, Krista.
Bye, Mo.
All right. I will be in touch and we'll have my assistant email you on how we can make that donation over to you. And send me what to your kids. And thank you so much as well.
Thank you.